on learning history, institutional racism, and some discussion of trade. We have Dr. Sheila Zibon, who's a senior lecturer in law at the University of Plymouth. We then have Dr. Paul McHugh, reader in law, Department of Land Economy, University of Cambridge. That will be followed by Madge Dresser, reader in history, University of the West of England. And closing will be Marika Sherwood, who is an honorary senior research fellow at the Institute of Cromwell Studies just down the road. Now, Marika Sherwood informed me that there is a book which is on sale outside for £5, and it's a big bargain, I think, for a fiver, which is entitled Britain, the Slave Trade and Slavery from 1562 to the 1880s. So, people who are interested in that historical perspective, please grab the book. But there are only 5 copies, so you'll just have to, you know, try and get there. Okay, so if I can introduce this, I haven't had introduced the speakers, they get 15 minutes. And once they've spoken, then we'll have time for questions. Thank you very much. So let's have our first speaker.
Good afternoon. 50 minutes is not long to cover the material of my paper, so really, there's got to just be highlights. So first of all, I'd like to add my disclaimer, who I am. I am an English common lawyer. This is the sort of narrowness, perhaps, of my perspective. And I came to look at this from an academic curiosity point of view as much as anything, with the 200th anniversary of the 1807 Act, and with books and films and various other media contributions focusing on the role of Wilberforce campaigners, etc. And coming from an era where I expect judges to act in accordance with human rights principles, I just got to be myself wondering, well, what were the courts doing, the English courts, this is, in the years leading up to the passing of the 1807 Act? And surely, I thought to myself, they must have made some contribution. Perhaps this was rather naive of me as I went through, but that was my level of inquiry to start with, and that's what the paper is based on. So I was looking for words, I suppose, which reflect a human rights perspective. Of course, the phrase human rights wasn't actually coined in the courts during the time that I was looking at. So I'm looking for evidence of other words and phrases, and this is, again, what I'm hoping to bring to you today. The other point, which, building on what Professor Parker said, Packer said earlier, was about people in power, and certainly I think that my slides will demonstrate to you that these were the people in power in this particular era in the English courts. So, highlights only, I'm afraid, in 15 minutes. And the first highlight is, and I've lost the title here, something happened to my slides, is the York Talbot opinion of 1729. Now, the York Talbot opinion is a result of lobbying by the plantation owners and West Indian plantation owners, slave traders, at this time, because there had been a series of cases in the late 1600s and early 1700s which raised the question of the property rights that a master held over his or her slave. So there was discussion in the courts, and you'll find it in several cases, which I haven't got time to focus on at the moment. But so in 1729, there was some disquiet. It was a time of huge increased investment in the commercial trade and the development of the plantations in the West Indies, and those people in power, the moneyed people, wanted to make sure that their investment was going to be sound and it wasn't going to be scuppered by any legal judgments. So there was some development at that time. And in Lincoln's Inn, just up the road here, on the evening of January the 14th, the plantation owners lobbied two powerful men, one of which, the image here is of Lord Hardwick, who was York Attorney General at the time, and the other was Talbot, who was Solicitor General. So out of their lobbying, there came this statement. And this had the effect of stopping in its tracks, perhaps, the debate that was happening in the few cases that had come through the courts at that time. So we are of the opinion that slaves, by coming from the West Indies to Great Britain, does not become free. So this was one of their concerns, and he made it clear that that was not going to be the case, and that his master's property or right in him is not thereby determined or varied, and that baptism does not bestow freedom on him. Another question that had come into some of the earlier cases was, does baptism bestow freedom? This was one of their worries. Nor make any alteration in his temporal condition in these kingdoms. We are also of opinion that his master may legally compel him to return again to the plantations. So this very much calmed the fears of the plantation owners and the slave traders at that time, and opened the floodgates to an enormous growth in the trade. So commerce flourished after the statement of this powerful man. And because he was somewhat concerned that his statement was given out of a judicial context, even though it didn't seem to have been challenged, 20 years later he reiterated it from the judicial bench. So this was obviously in 1740-ish. So 20 years later. So this statement held sway for a long time, and from my research seems to have dampened any attempts by the courts to question these particular issues. The next significant event, which are probably familiar to, which I want to be drawing to your attention, are the cases which came from before Lord Mansfield. Now, a couple of things to say about Lord Mansfield. One of Lord Mansfield's, perhaps the strongest benefactor and patron of Mansfield, was Lord Hardwick. So, bringing upon this sort of people in power issue, Mansfield obviously was an incredibly clever lawyer in his own right, but in order to get to this position, he would have needed support from somebody else because he didn't have that natural social level. So, Hardwick was one of his possibly main benefactor and patron. Now, a series of cases came before him, and I've put them up there. Jonathan Strong, Thomas Lewis, and James Stewart, three slavery cases that came before him. So we're already, getting on for 50 years after the York Talbot opinion here. And you will find reference to Lord Mansfield's reticence in making the decision that he eventually made in Somerset, or making it in such a narrow way, because one of his fears was that he didn't want to go against the York Talbot opinion. So this clearly was held in great regard. But Somerset versus Stuart, 1772, which went on for 6 months in the court. It took a long time for Mansfield to make the decision for various reasons. And then this statement comes from the case that he made. The state of slavery is of such a nature that it is incapable of being introduced on any reasons, moral or political, but only by positive law. It's so odious that nothing can be suffered to support it but positive law. Whatever inconveniences, therefore, may follow from a decision, I cannot say this case is allowed or approved by the law of England, and therefore the black must be discharged. next case I want to bring to your attention is not so many years later, but still 10, where the legal issue was slightly different. Here we have the case of the notorious slave ship Zong, Gregson versus Gilbert, 1783. Now, the facts were, and I'm sure this just came into the public domain, but would possibly have been something that happened on other ships. There was a shortage of water due to the length of the voyage, and in order to save some rather than the many, the decision was made by the captain to throw slaves overboard. Now, the issue that came before court was nothing to do with the morality of the throwing of the slaves overboard. The issue before the court was whether or not the loss, the financial loss, should lie with the insurance company or the ship owner. So the insurance legislation at that time was quite vague and talked about perils of the sea. So there was some discretion there. The case was heard before a jury, and this is Mansfield speaking about the before the case was decided, where he says the matter left to the jury was whether it was from necessity that the slaves were thrown into the sea, for they had no doubt, though it shocks one very much, that the case of slaves was the same as if horses had been thrown overboard. And it was held in this case that it was a catastrophe linked to the perils of the sea, and the insurance company agreed to pay £30 for the slaves that had been thrown overboard. So it was a financial loss. Now, Granville Sharp, the great campaigner for slave trade at that time, attempted to lobby for the captain, Luke Collingwood, to be brought before the courts on a charge of manslaughter. But this fell on deaf ears. So this is a trade case again, it's a commercial case, and the issue of whether or not this chattel that had been lost at sea was human cargo or horses or perhaps bags of grain was not going to be standing in the way of applying the legislation. The final case, which I'm going to mention to you, again on the Atlantic slave trade, is a post-Mansfield case. Now, Lord Kenyon, in this picture, came after Lord Mansfield as Chief Justice. He wasn't, when Lord Mansfield was asked to say who should, presumably this is how it was done, and maybe still is, who should come after him. He didn't want Kenyon to succeed him in the role. He didn't think he had sufficient intellectual rigour to be Chief Justice, and had an alternative, a guy called Buller, that he wanted to put forward as his choice for the job. But Kenyon had come up through the ranks in the same way that Mansfield had himself, so was well placed to take on the role. And Tatham and Hodgson came before him in 1796. Now, I think obviously we're getting towards the 1800 point here, and how much credit, if there is credit, do we give to Lord Kenyon for his doubts about the slave trade in this case, and how much that is swayed and influenced by public opinion at that time, which was clearly mobilised specifically after the Zong case, which offended a lot of people. There was 1788 insurance legislation had been placed greater responsibility on the ship owner for the welfare of slaves after the Zong. So there had been some legislation passed, and this legislation was not exactly clear, but said that the ship owners could not absolve their responsibility and pass their financial losses quite so easily onto the insurance companies. So there was an economic, something economic in it for the ship owners to make sure that they did protect in some way the welfare of the slaves on board. And when Lord Kenyon came to apply the legislation, the 1788 legislation, to this very similar case, except here the slaves in question had starved to death on board due to the fact that there was a lack of food and the voyage had taken longer than anticipated. And there we find this reference to humanity that I put on the slide, this Act of Parliament being founded in humanity. So a recognition of the slavery issue, we ought not on any account put such a construction on it as to render it useless, even if expressions are doubtful. So he's exercising some discretion here. A captain who knows the possible length of the voyage does not discharge his duty if he takes an insufficient quantity of provisions. So I put it to you that perhaps there has been some sort of step change in attitude of the judiciary here, or at least a realisation that they may be behind the public opinion of the day and need to do a bit of catching up. There's reports in this case also that Kenyon did actually ask counsel representing the ship owners, and this just came from a newspaper report, when he said, well, did the captain starve to death? And he was answered in the negative. So, again, adds possibly to the thought that there is some awakening here. So we're moving perhaps into a more enlightened approach. And I just finish here on this case of Williams and Brown, which I could have picked several cases. I picked this one. Here's Williams, who is in fact himself an ex-slave, who's bringing a civil action in the courts for money in his own, in the civil courts for himself. So we've moved from where the slave has been the issue, do I own it? A dominion kind of issue that we saw in the Somerset cases, to the value of trade, the value of the slave as trade in the insurance type issues, to a situation in 1802 where this Williams is able to go to the courts himself in order to put a claim in. Well, I haven't got time to do the facts at the moment, but he was himself a slave, and then he went back to Grenada, and unfortunately, that was where he had been a slave, so he was claimed by his master. The ship owner attempted to release him and gave him a new contract. So here, again, I just wanted to pick up on the comments of Justice Chambers. Upholding an agreement, he said, which would ensure that Williams was relieved from punishment, this is punishment for running away from Grenada, was a free man and would receive compensation for his seafaring services, albeit less than he wanted, because he was claiming for enforcement of a contract he'd made whilst in England. And he commented, in this case, an actual manumission took place. The master was a party to the agreement, and nothing occurred in the transaction to impeach the validity of the contract. This is a decision which I think the court bound by the rules of law to make, and which is most consistent with the dictates of humanity. So I just finish on that point from to say that these cases are the highlights, if you like, and the last two of where the judges had considered in their deliberations this notion of humanity. Thank you.